Today is Thursday, January 3rd, 2019. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Bruce Wilson. My name is Tom Martin. Bruce Wilson is normal spelling, B-R-U-C-E-W-I-L-S-O-N. And Bruce, good morning. How are you?
I'm terrific.
Great.
Good to talk with you, Tom.
Oh, you too. May we have your permission this morning to record this conversation?
Yes, of course.
Thank you so very much. Bruce, what year were you born?
1929.
Okay. What were your parents doing, and where were you born?
I was born at the old Stanford Hospital in downtown San Francisco. Stanford Hospital is now located on the campus down in Palo Alto, but I was born at Stanford Hospital in San Francisco, and my mother was born in San Francisco, and my grandmother was born in San Francisco.
Wow.
On the maternal side, yeah.
Huh. How did your mother meet your dad?
They met after World War One. My dad had just come home from the Army, and my mother was working, I guess, as a secretary or receptionist at an outfit called the War Camp Community Service, which was, I guess, a World War One kind of USO. And my father walked in the door, and I guess he had on half civilian clothes and half Army uniform. And my mother thought that was pretty funny, and she laughed.
Huh.
And I guess they became... That was the beginning of a brief courtship, but they were engaged within a few weeks and married within the year. I'm not sure exactly what year they were married.
What did your father do in the Great War?
Well, he was in the Army. He became a second lieutenant. I don't believe he ever got out of what he called Fort Lewis or Camp Lewis in Washington State. So he didn't fire, you know, he wasn't under any action under fire.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. So he served stateside. Okay.
Yeah.
And then did you grow up in San Francisco then?
No, I grew up down the peninsula in Burlingame. My parents built their home in Burlingame, which is halfway between San Francisco and San Jose. My dad commuted to his office in San Francisco, but I spent my whole through high school there in Burlingame, California.
What did your father do in San Francisco?
Well, he had a little advertising agency with actually only had one account, but it was a pretty good account. He had the telephone company account, but he would go up to his office in the late morning because he really wanted to write full time. He'd been a newspaper reporter before World War One, and he really wanted to just write. And he would stay home and write in the mornings, and then about 11 o'clock he'd go up to San Francisco, and he had a secretary and a lettering artist and another artist that worked in that office for him, and I think he did pretty well.
Yeah. Where was your, if your mom and her mother were born in San Francisco, where was your dad from on his side?
Well, he was born in Minneapolis, but his father was sort of an itinerant insurance salesman or insurance broker, and he moved. They spent a lot of time living in boarding houses when he grew up. I think he went to 11 different grammar schools and high schools.
Wow.
But they ended up in the East Bay in Alameda in the Oakland area. And my dad went to Alameda High School and then to Stanford. He was in a class of 1912. I think that's one reason we stayed put in Burlingame. I think he moved so many times that we just stayed put there at Burlingame.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I had an older sister, Nancy Jane, and she was 4 years older than me.
Okay.
She's gone now.
Okay. Did you guys do camping when you were kids? What did you do for entertainment after school?
Well, in the winters, we skied. My dad was one of the first people that skied up in the Sierra. And so at an early age, I guess maybe 5 or 6, he would take my sister and me skiing, and we'd stay in, there was a funny old hotel in downtown Truckee, California. We'd stay there. Sometimes we'd stay at the Sierra Club Lodge up at Donner's Summit, the Claire Tappan Lodge.
Okay.
And so we skied in the winter. In the summers, we'd take trips to Mount Lass and Amberberg, and we didn't really do a lot of camping out because my mother was not an outdoors person. But we'd spend time in the outdoors, that's for sure.
Okay.
And then when I was in high school, of course, that was after the 1942 river trip, I started spending a lot more time in the mountains. We had some good friends, the Rieger family, who we skied with, and they were also backpackers, and you could rent a burro at Yosemite for $1 a day.
Wow.
And just take off into the Yosemite backcountry, and we used to do that in the summer, so it was really fun.
So this would have been in the late 1940s?
Yeah. That would have been, I know we were back at Benson Lake in the Yosemite backcountry the summer of 1945 where the war ended. We didn't know the war was over.
Wow.
My dad and I hiked out to the highway, which had a place called White Wolf that's in Yosemite Park, up on the road to Tuolumne Meadows.
Okay.
And we hiked out, and I think we did 25 miles about from Benson Lake to get to the White Wolf campground. And when we got there, there were all sorts of cars going down the road there. We were really surprised because gas had been rationed and there was never any traffic.
Uh-huh.
So we said, well, what's all this traffic? And he said, well, didn't you know the war's over?
Oh, my gosh.
Over, the atomic bomb had been dropped. And we missed the whole thing, which really, really bugged me because I heard about the big celebration in downtown San Francisco and I missed it.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So you would have been 12, 13, 14, 15 then.
Yeah,
roughly.
Roughly 15, 16.
Okay. Did you backpack a lot with your dad? Did he like to hit up in the Sierras as well that way?
Well, mostly he had done that stuff earlier. I mean, he was a mountain climber. One of these guys I think he climbed every 14,000-foot peak around, certainly in California, if not on the West Coast.
Wow.
And, but he seemed to give that up when I was a little kid. Maybe he felt it was dangerous and he shouldn't do that. I don't know. But he, we always had sleeping bags and we were always sleeping out somewhere.
Oh, fun.
But the pack trips were really, I think that one that summer the war ended was the only one that my dad and I did together.
Hmm.
But I did a number of them after that, for many years after, with my family and my kids.
Okay, fun. How did you meet the Marstons? What are your first recollections of them?
Well, they were friends of my dad's, and I'm not sure how my dad and Odie Marston met. I strongly suspect that it was through the Sierra Club, though, because they were both active in the early days of the Sierra Club. There was a fellow named Francis Farquhar who may have even been president of the Sierra Club at one point.
Yep.
And later on, he was one of my sponsors into the Bohemian Club in San Francisco.
Ah.
But Odie and my dad certainly were acquainted back in the 30s and skied together. And that's where I first remember meeting Garth, was on ski trips and up at the Claire Tappan Lodge, the Sierra Club ski lodge. I would guess it was either through the Sierra Club, or maybe they both belonged to the Olympic Club. My dad belonged to the Olympic Club in San Francisco. He used to go there to swim, at lunchtime and have lunch there.
Okay.
So
did your dad like swimming?
He liked exercise. He didn't.
Okay.
He wasn't a dedicated swimmer, but he liked to stay in shape.
Okay. What do you remember about Francis Farquhar? That's Farquhar, I think. Farquhar?
I think so. I'd have to check it.
Yeah.
I think that sounds right.
We'll sort it out.
I don't remember a whole lot about Francis Farquhar. I know that he was a CPA. He was a very nice guy. He spoke with sort of a Harvard accent. I think the last time I saw him was to go, spend a little time with him at his camp at the Bohemia Grove.
Hmm.
And he acted as my sponsor, I'm sure because he was a friend of my dad's. I mean, he didn't really know me.
Okay, yeah.
And I didn't really know him.
Okay.
But he's a nice guy. I think very studious sort of a fellow,
Okay.
A great lover of the outdoors.
Okay. And Garth, then Garth would have been 3 or 4 years older than you, your sister's age, I suppose.
Yeah, he was closer to my sister in age, maybe a little younger. But I remember I looked up to Garth. He was a much better skier than I was. Of course, he was older. And I think I mentioned to you one other time when we spoke, I remember there being a yodeling contest at the Sierra Club Ski Lodge.
Huh.
And Garth won the yodeling contest, and they gave him a pair of, I remember this to this day, they gave him a pair of metal ski poles. Well, we had bamboo ski poles. I'd never seen a metal ski pole.
Wow.
And they were blue, and they were the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
Oh, my gosh. Huh.
And he was a good skier and a good guy. But I didn't spend a lot of time with him until that summer of 42 on the river.
Okay. You mentioned the Claire Tappan Lodge. What do you remember about the lodge? This would have been in the 30s, late 30s into the early 40s?
The time that I spent more time there in the 40s than at any other time.
Okay.
My dad and his buddies, and that may have included Marston and Farquhar, I don't know. I really don't know. Certainly included another friend of his, Tom Rieger, R-I-E-G-E-R.
Thank you.
They apparently got a Forest Service lease of a piece of property there at Norden, N-O-R-D-E-N, which is right up at Donner Summit. There was a train flag stop there in the train sheds across the Sierra. And they used to go up and go skiing. I never did this, but they used to go up and go skiing in the 30s and sleep outside in their sleeping bags in the snow.
Wow.
There wasn't any, and they'd stay on that property, and they'd ski over what is now the Sugar Bowl ski resort, because that faced north and had the best snow.
Okay.
And they'd cross the railroad tracks there through the train sheds and hike in on skis to the Sugar Bowl and ski there and come back. Sometimes they'd sleep in the train sheds if it was snowing hard. But in any event, when the Sierra Club wanted to build a lodge, they planned to build it further down the mountain what's the name of that place? It'll come to me.
Okay,
but
no worries.
It was further down the mountain. It was a lower altitude. And so my dad and his friends said to the Sierra Club, look, you guys are crazy to build it down there because you won't have snow every winter. Why don't you put it up on this property? And I think that's how that Claire Tapon Lodge got placed where it is. I presume it's still there. I haven't been there in years. My dad used to spend a week in the summers. He'd go up there, and when they were building the first addition of that lodge, of course, there were a lot of additions made through the years. And I think the story that I recall, and again, I wasn't there myself, is that he pulled the big beams up into place with his 1929 Packard.
Wow.
So I think that's how that Claire Tapon Lodge got placed where it is.
Nice. Okay. I stayed there probably 10 years ago, and there was discussion at the time about keeping it or not, whether the club would sell it. So I haven't followed that discussion since, but
I haven't at all either.
It has a great heritage, a great amount of history there. So,
but we had a lot of fun there. Yeah.
Nice. What else, was there anything else that was an interesting story or unique event that happened before, that 1942 river trip?
As far as the rivers were concerned, I remember my dad going off to go down the San Juan River with Norm Nevels and coming back really enthusiastic about it. I don't know how they connected. I have no idea how they connected.
Francis.
Somehow my dad went over there, and they hiked around Monument Valley, and they slept up on top of the Rainbow Bridge, or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
There's some sort of a rock formation that I've never been to. I've never seen.
So this would have been a trip in May of 1942, organized by Francis Farquhar. And I think it actually might have been a Sierra Club trip. And your dad invited Otis, talked to Otis about it, but there wasn't any room. There wasn't, for some reason, Otis didn't go.
Uh-huh.
But Francis is the guy who set your dad up for that.
Okay, well, that's interesting to me, and I didn't know that. but I could just visualize that being the case.
Okay. And you mentioned your dad was excited when he came back. What do you remember anything he talked about the trip or said about it?
Well, he was really impressed with the San Juan River and the amount of silt that it carried. He said it was just like a moving mud stream.
Huh.
But the water was, it was fun, and I think he really connected with Norm Nevels and just felt that he was onto something that was a real treat, and he wanted to stay involved. He never went completely nuts over it. But it was just something that he enjoyed, and of course, he worked me into it, which was very fortunate from my standpoint.
How did he do that? Why bring his son? Why was that important?
Well, to my knowledge, and again, my dad never talked to me about financial stuff and all that. So I'm surmising. But it's an educated surmise because, he must have said things that left very strong impressions that I recall very, very strongly. So my understanding, and I'm pretty darn sure it's accurate, is that Norm was trying to build a business and make a living taking people down the river, and he was doing pretty well on the San Juan River, but he'd successfully run the Colorado, and he wanted to build that business, but people were afraid to go, and it was kind of a scary thing. You heard tales about lives being lost and people going in there and never coming out the other end.
Yeah,
and so he, you know, we're struggling to get passengers, paying passengers, and I never did have any idea how much he charged, because that sort of thing wasn't discussed with me.
Uh-huh.
But my understanding is that my dad said, "Look, Norm, I think if you take my son, and maybe I can get Marson to bring his son, you'll get some good publicity out of this, and people will be more comfortable about the hazards or the safety of going down the river." So they made some sort of a deal, and my belief is that I rode free. I couldn't prove that, but I think I rode free. My dad paid whatever the price was, and I don't know whether Garth rode free or not, but in any event, the two boys were included from our father's standpoint. We were probably included because our dads thought, "Hey, this would be a wonderful trip for our kids, wonderful experience." But from the business standpoint, I think it was to generate publicity for Norm's business.
Okay, and this makes sense from what I've heard as well. Is that your dad came back after the San Juan trip very excited, and talked to Odie?
Yeah,
that's spelled ODY. And
yeah.
and said, "Hey, you know, get your son, I'll get my son, and we'll do a father-son trip." And Odie was a good swimmer, and Garth was a good swimmer. Were you a good swimmer?
Well, I was a pretty good swimmer for a 12, 13-year-old.
Okay.
A couple years later in high school, I was on the water polo team, and I don't think we ever won a game. but I wasn't a really competitive swimmer, but I could stay afloat. That's for sure.
Okay. Okay, well, that's important. And
Yeah.
you know, you liked it enough to go into water polo. That you answered that question, which is that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a journey you know nothing about. Your dad's going, and Garth is going, and Odie's going, and you know them all. What kind of gear did you pack? Do you remember the kind of stuff you brought?
We had our sleeping bags, and I had the sleeping bag that had been my dad's. And it was the first mummy bag that I was ever aware of. I don't know
Wow.
whether he had it specially made years before, but I remember it tapered down, and it was a nice sleeping bag and a very light. And we packed our gear. He went down. There was a sporting goods store on Market Street in San Francisco, Spiros, Spiros, and he tried to buy little bags with drawstrings that were made of material that was somewhat waterproof. We didn't have the materials available. A lot of them, hadn't been even developed yet, and also there was war on, and a lot of stuff was scarce.
Right.
But I remember having a couple of tennis racket covers, they're the shape of a tennis racket cover, that was made of some material that was, it wasn't oilcloth, but it was something that kind of felt like that on the exterior, and you could pull the little neck part that would normally go around the tennis racket handle. You could pull that pretty tight, and
Huh.
we put stuff in things like that. I had another little canvas. What, it isn't a canvas. It was just some sort of a, not completely waterproof, but like an oil cloth type of bags that we had stuff in. But we didn't take much stuff. Had a
Right.
swimming suit, a pair of jeans, and a shirt, a couple of shirts maybe, and not a hell of a lot else. I mean, we were wet the whole time during the day on the boat, so it didn't make any difference.
Had you been east before? Had you taken the train, over to Kingman and up to Flagstaff? Had you been out into that country before?
I'd never been in that country before. The only long train trip I'd ever had was in 1938. Dad and Mom took my sister and me to Europe, and we took the train across the United States to New York, and then took an Italian ship to Europe.
Wow.
And that was just before World War II began. In fact, Austria had already fallen, but he wanted to us to see Europe before what he was sure was going to be a history-changing conflict.
Wow.
And so we spent that summer, but going across the country in the train, I remember, this really has nothing to do with the river trip, but I do remember. And then, how old was I then? 1938. I was 8 or 9.
Yeah.
He gave me all the train tickets, which came, in a long string. They were like tickets to the carnival or something. They were these little tickets all in a long string, and he gave them to me, and he said, "Don't lose these tickets. They're your responsibility." And I had an upper berth, and I put them inside my shoe, and I wore my shoe to bed in the upper berth so that I wouldn't lose our tickets.
Wow.
So I'd been on a train before, but yes, getting back to business, we took the train
Bruce,
to
hang on.
Flagstaff.
Before we get back to business, what do you remember about Europe in 1938 as an 8 or 9 year old?
Huge swastika flags hanging from every flagpole, pictures of Adolf Hitler, you know, staring off into the, you know, looking forward into the world. And,
yep.
And I remember my dad said, don't refer to him as Hitler. If you want to talk about Hitler, call him Mr. Schultz.
Huh.
Because you don't know who's listening. And so we would talk about Mr. Schultz when we wanted to laugh at him or disparage him.
Wow.
And I remember my father, this is sort of a funny story. My dad, the zipper on my dad's fly broke.
Okay.
And so he was walking around holding a map in front of his trousers. And he wanted to find somebody that would fix his pants.
Oh, gosh.
And there was a Jewish tailor shop. And I'm not sure whether this was in Vienna or whether it was in Munich or where it was, but it was in one of the German, in Germany.
Hmm.
And this Jewish tailor shop had a sign on it, of course, proclaiming that the owner was Jewish.
Wow.
Don't do business here. And so he made a beeline for that place to give the guy some business.
Wow.
And got his zipper fixed. I remember we all got a big laugh out of that. But
wow.
he was big on having these experiences. And we also... we're on the last Matson line trip out into the Pacific in 1941. We took the last cruise. We went to Honolulu and then Samoa and then Tahiti. And that was in May or June of 1941. And that was, you know, that was just before World War II as well, so...
Wow.
Before the Pacific War.
So these are some pretty expansive traveling trips for a young man. And that would, I think that would serve you well in the Arizona wilderness on a boat.
Oh, yeah. There's no question. And, you know, the sense of doing things that other people weren't doing, that was what we were all about.
Wow. Fun.
But it wasn't. My dad never did it with a sense of showing off or trying to be number one and having accomplished something. That sort of thing wasn't important at all.
Was he trying to just give you and your sister a well-rounded understanding of the world, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think definitely. Before we go on these trips, he'd always put a map of the area we were going to visit. He put a map on the wall by the toilet.
Hmm. Okay. Great.
And, you know, by the time we got to where we were going, we were pretty familiar with it. You know,
yeah.
With the geography.
Neat.
Yeah.
Good idea. Okay, yeah. So did you take the train out of San Francisco? Or did you guys drive to Los Angeles? How did that work, that getting to and from the river back then?
I believe that we took the train to L.A. and then another train out of L.A. to Flagstaff. I'm sure we didn't drive.
Okay. And then...
Nobody had gas, and, you know, gas was rationed.
You would have arrived in Flagstaff in the middle of the night, and then...
Yes.
Switched to a bus that was heading
yep.
north, and when the sun came up, you would have been on the backside of Mars. the country would have looked very different from anything Berkeley had to offer. Do you remember any first impressions about that country?
Well, I remember ending up there at Lee's Ferry. And we rolled our sleeping bags out, spent the following night there before we took off the next morning. And, yeah, I mean, it was a lot of rocks. And the trees were not about as big as the trees we had in California.
Yep.
And it was different than anything I'd seen, but I had seen, you know, I'd seen pictures of the Grand Canyon and that sort of thing. So I wasn't in shock over it, but it was different.
Do you remember piling into the, was it a Chevy sedan with the boat stuck on the back of it on a trailer going down to the river? Do you recall any of that?
I do not recall in that detail. I mean, I do recall the sense of it being real early in the morning when we got off that bus, but I don't recall exactly where we got off the bus, and I don't recall exactly how we got down
okay.
to East Ferry.
So on that river trip, certainly was the people rowing the boats. There was Norm Nevels and
right.
Preston Walker and
yes.
Wayne McConkie. That's McConkie.
Yes.
And then the passengers were you and your dad and Odie and Garth. And did Garth have a nickname, or was he just Garth?
He was just Garth,
okay.
if I recall. Yeah.
And then there were two more Eds, Ed Hudson, the pharmacist, and Ed Olson, the camera guy.
Right.
And I think that was it.
That was it.
And so take it away. What do you remember about that? Then what happened?
Well, I remember we got assigned the boats, and I think part of it was based on how much we weighed and how much stuff the boat already had stowed in it. But also part of it was probably, and again, I can only surmise this, probably Norm wanted to keep my dad and me on the same boat, which he did. And so my dad and I were assigned to the Wen, which was Norm Neville's, the boat that he was rowing, and Garth rode in the cockpit sort of in the pointy end. My dad and I rode out on the deck, that square stern that went first through the water, through the rapids. And of course, the deck was the deck had these lines that were how do I describe it? They were placed across the decks, very close. You could just get your fingers and toes under these rope lines,
okay,
so that you could hang on when you're going through the rapids.
Okay,
and you just rode on that plywood decking, and that was home.
There was a hatch that went through that deck. Did you have a hard time making friends with that hatch?
Well, you sort of wrapped yourself around the hatch. You know, it had a handle, and that would dig into you. And so there were some edges that would dig into you. But again, it was so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, in between the rapids, you just floated. It was so serene, and you just, and then you could hear this roar. It was like a bunch of freight trains around the corner, and you knew that there was a rapid coming up, and would sort of the anticipation would grow until you came around the bend, usually we would, if it was any kind of a rapid, we'd pull over to the side while Norm would get out and give a great study.
Talk about that. Would he? And he was smoking sort of
cool cigarettes.
Cools. Okay.
Yeah, cool.
And
oh, he smoked cools. He was really hooked on the cools. And he smoked the cigarettes
Was he a chain smoker?
I wouldn't say a chain smoker, but he was certainly a pack or more a day.
Okay.
Smoker.
Okay.
Yeah. you know, he couldn't smoke too much when he was in the boat. Although, as I recall, he'd have a cigarette between his lips while we were just kind of floating between the rapids.
Okay. And then scouting, he would spend some time looking over the rapids?
He'd look over the rapids. He'd talk about it. He'd talk it over with Press Walker. He'd talk it over with Wayne McConkie. You know, they'd try and figure out which way they're going to run the rapid. And I'm sure that Odie and my dad and everybody else chipped in, too, with their 2 cents worth.
Okay.
I certainly didn't have much to contribute, but I was there, part of the gang.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
Nice. And then the first night's camp. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember the sand was blowing. But that became something that you just got used to.
Okay.
There was sand in everything. There was sand in your food. There was sand in your sleeping bag. but you sort of had the attitude of, what the hell? You
know,
that's just the way it is. And it was part of the fun. We kind of laughed at it, really.
Were there lots of sandy beaches here and there?
Yeah, almost every place where the river takes a bend, there would be a buildup of sand.
Wow.
And usually those beaches also would catch a lot of driftwood, and there'd be huge, huge piles of driftwood on these sandbars. You know, my recollection is that they were about the same size as they used to have at Stanford before the big game.
Wow.
Cal, they had a bonfire rally before the big football game.
Mm-hmm.
These things were huge, huge. I don't know how many cords of wood they had. And we often just lit them off and let the fire burn and saw the beautiful sight of the lights against the canyon walls from these fires. I suppose now the environmentalists would say that was a terrible thing to do. And maybe it was a terrible thing to do, but it was what we did.
Did you burn any piles of wood while you were traveling during the day? You'd come upon a big pile and say, "Well, come on, let's light it up," and then head on downstream.
I don't recall doing that.
Okay.
I recall doing that at night.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And there is a some film footage of you and Garth and a couple of the other guys sitting on a giant log. Do you, in the water, like,
yeah,
on the second day or so, do you remember that at all?
I vaguely remember that. I can't give you any details, but obviously, it was a big old tree that was floating down the river, and we climbed on it and took a little ride.
I was amazed. The four of you, four adult men, basically, sitting on this log dry. I mean, the log was big enough that you all could sit on it without, you know, getting your feet wet. And the bathroom was just a roll of toilet paper around the corner.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Exactly
right. And I remember it must have been the years later at the Snake and Salmon River trip that Press Walker was talking about when he fought on the Battle of Kasserine Pass in North Africa. And he said the worst thing about that desert campaign in World War II was they got ahead of the toilet paper supply, and he said, you know, the troops were struggling to find a round, smooth stone.
Yeah.
was all they had.
Wow.
But anyway, back to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So lots of sand, lots of driftwood, lots of water. Was it raining Did it rain on you guys?
Yeah, we had rain showers. I mean, generally the weather was, as you know, because you live in that area, but it was hot. It was, you know, 110, 115,
mm-hmm.
Maybe sometimes hotter than that, degrees. But there would be thunder showers that would sprinkle a little rain on us, and it felt good. And it never seemed to bother anybody when it rained, and it was just, you know, just part of the scene.
Yeah. Did you get in the water to cool off at all?
Oh yes, and we get, you know, when we were going down between rapids, where, you know, you could get off the boat and hang onto the edge and be dragged along, or when we were camped on a sandbar, where we'd get in it and be in the water. The water, of course, was very warm.
Okay.
And I'm told that now that water is much colder because they built the Glen Canyon Dam.
Yes.
And the amount of silt and the temperature of the water has been changed as a result of that.
Greatly.
So,
yeah.
But the water was warm, like almost like soup.
But was it a
very,
place?
Very filled with sand. I mean, we took a bucket once and let the sand settle, let the silt settle, and it was close to 30-40% sand.
Wow. Did you go to the water to escape the heat? Meaning,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we stayed wet. That's how you stayed comfortable.
Got it. Okay.
So it was good to be wet.
And the river was silty. I'm sorry I interrupted. The bucket was
That's
a third okay. full of dirt once it had settled out.
Yep.
Do you remember then, Nakaweep, there was a clear running stream there, a big wide open area with a Indian ruin way up on the hillside. You'd hike up there.
That was a beautiful spot.
Huh.
And was Nakaweep where there was a waterfall? I'm trying to remember. I'd have to look at my own journal.
Yeah.
To express my mind. But
there was a stream there. Big wide open valley, but not a big waterfall. That was Deer Creek, had the giant waterfall, 100-foot high, powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
Beat you up there when you go try to get in the water.
That's
after Phantom Ranch, and that's after the flip, Wayne McConkie and Ed Hudson's flip in their boat. So we'll get there, but not quite
okay.
yet.
Okay.
So Nakaweep, big fires on the beach in the evening at the driftwood piles.
Yep.
So let's go to the Little Colorado River. Would have been a side canyon coming in on the left. I think it was muddy maybe when you were there, or I'm not sure if you guys spent a lot of time there.
I don't recall that we spent a lot of time there. I do recall that it was very another silt carrier.
Yeah.
Coming in on the left. Yeah, on the port side.
Yep. During the monsoon season, that makes perfect sense. It's carrying a lot of silt in there. Then not too far downstream from there, Wayne McConkie rolled his boat over. What happened there?
Well, it happened very quickly. My dad and I and Norm had come down. I guess Garth was in the boat. We'd come down first through the rapid, and my dad was looking upstream, and Norm, I don't know which way Norm was looking. Normally he was watching the other boats come through very, very carefully, but anyway, I remember my dad saying in a very calm voice, which was typical of him, my dad saying, they're over, or something worse to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
They're over, Norm. Well, what he was saying is that the boat had gone over, and finally Norm realized what had happened, and here came the boat, and we couldn't, at first we couldn't see any people, and but one of the passengers was on the other side of the boat hanging on, and was fine. The other one was under the boat, but up in the air compartment of the cockpit. And I can't remember which was who and who was which, but they both got out of there and came through fine.
Okay.
So it was a moment of excitement. And I would say it was more excitement than terror. I
mean, uh-huh.
There was no panic. It was just, it was part of a, whoops, here we go.
Uh-huh.
Thing, and everybody kind of laughed it off. Maybe the guys who got dunked in the nobody else seemed to take too much measure of it.
Uh-huh. Did you have any gear in that boat that got wet, or was that your stuff was over in the wind?
My stuff was in the wind.
Okay.
And I don't recall in some of the material that you said that there was some discussion about stuff getting wet and the boats leaking and that sort of thing. I don't recall having a problem with our gear. Stuff did get wet. But who cared?
Right.
I mean, so
well, you cared if you had a camera.
Well, that's true. My dad had an Argus camera, which was, I thought that was a pretty neat thing.
Uh-huh.
And he was never much of a cameraman, but he was taking a picture and he was standing on the deck of the boat and of the wind, and I don't know whether somebody suggested step back a little further. anyway, he went in with the camera.
Ooh.
And eventually he gave the camera to me. And I was thrilled to get that camera. But I've still got the box that camera came in. It was sort of a blue velvet covered box. But I have a collection of old badges and things in it. Yeah.
Fun.
I don't know where we started this sentence, but
well, we were talking about water and things getting wet and your
yeah.
dad's camera and then him falling off the boat.
So
the boat flipped. There was no big deal. I mean, it was just like turn the boat back over and get back to it, and that was that.
Pretty much that was that.
Was Wayne a little upset about that, or was he, okay, fine, no problem? I mean, what do you remember about Wayne McConkie?
Quiet guy, and he stayed to himself a little bit more than most of the people were together. I think he is a very good Mormon, and he wore his long underwear the whole time. I remember that. I guess he didn't, show his body.
Okay.
He was just the nicest guy. He was always very good to me.
Nice.
He took me fishing one day and somewhere along the line. And what can I say? I think I was not aware of the fact that he was nervous, but in reading some of the materials that have been written about the trip later on, I realized that he was new at this, and his hands had a lot of blisters on them.
Mm-hmm.
He was maybe wondering whether he had gotten a little bit over his head, but I was not conscious of that as a 12, 13-year-old at all. I just thought he was, he was Wayne McConkie from Moab, Utah.
Uh-huh.
He could handle those big oars.
Nice. It sounds like just every other river runner that's still out there today, a little unsure, a little nervous. Yeah. Fun.
Yeah, really.
So the big rapids then above Phantom Ranch, do they does any of that ring a bell? Anything else happen in that area that?
Yeah, I remember. I think with the Sacknowledger wrapping up above Phantom Ranch, I think
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember coming through the Sacknowledger Rapid, and just the name of it was exciting. Sacknowledger, and you could hear that thing roaring before we got there, and I did get to run the rapid in the boat, and it was my dad and I would sing while we were going through the rapids. We'd sing songs. There was one song, "Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me." That was a popular song in 1942, and we'd sing that, and we were singing, I don't know what else, but "The Water Crash Over You," and it was just great. It was so much fun. I can't describe it.
Fun. And then you got the Phantom Ranch, this oasis in the desert. What do you remember about that?
Well, I don't remember much about the physical setup there, except that it was a really pleasant break. They had a swimming pool, and of course, as a kid, that was really fun. You could jump in the swimming pool. The people were especially nice to me. My mother had sent the makings for a birthday cake. I think it was a devil's food cake, which was my favorite. And so they had a birthday cake for me.
Nice.
And the park superintendent and his wife came all the way down there from the rim, from the south rim, and had a meal with us, and were very, very kind. And I think they maybe, some of those people took a little ride with us as we left Phantom Ranch, and down the river a little bit to a spot where they could get out and still hike out.
Right.
So it was a nice break, and we had a chance. I don't remember having a telephone conversation or anything with my mother, but it seems to me that with a boat went over, somebody could see that episode from the rim. There was a place up on the rim that had a telescope, and they could see the river at that point.
That's right.
And somebody, I think it was a United Press reporter, phoned my mother and said, "We understand there's been an accident on the river, and one of the boats had turned over, and it looked pretty bad." And so she was under the impression that maybe we were lost souls down there. And
oh my gosh.
Somehow, I'm sure that she was glad to hear when we got to Phantom Ranch, but I don't remember any telephone conversation or anything. I don't even know if there was such a thing.
There was. They did have a phone, and that was the typical thing to do. But you're right. The press had seen that flip, and they were concerned about it. So.
Yeah, I think she was. I think she was pretty worried because she had no idea what this trip was all about. Really.
Right.
I mean, she had just, she worshipped my father, and everything he wanted to do was fine with her, but she didn't have a clue that she thought. Probably that it was like going down the Mississippi in a riverboat or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a little different than that. Huh.
Yeah, it was a little different than that.
So then below Phantom, more rapids, more water. What do you remember now about Press Walker?
Well, I just thought he was a great guy. He was just a super guy. I was vaguely aware that he had a problem of some kind, and he did have a drinking problem, but I was only vaguely aware of there being such a thing as a drinking problem at that age.
Yeah.
He just seemed to be able to handle himself on the river, and he was, I just thought he was a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
think he was.
You
I
mentioned
think I was right.
Yeah. You mentioned a story he told about his service in World War II. Do you remember any other tales that he told about that time?
No, I don't. He must have had those experiences after that 1942 trip.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
And I must have heard those stories from him, when we were on the Snake and the Salmon. Because I think that was 42. It must have been before he went to the Army.
That's exactly right.
But I may be wrong.
No, you're exactly right. I'm wrong on that. You're exactly right. It's between 1942 and 1946. He went into the service right after your 1942 trip.
Yeah. I knew that he'd gone to the Menlo School, which is down right next to Stanford University, that his dad was had the newspaper at Grand Junction.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he just was a good guy. He was a really good guy.
Nice. And what do you remember about Ed Hudson, the druggist from Paso Robles?
Well, he was a big man.
Okay.
And you mentioned he's from Paso Robles. My memory is that he was from Banning.
Okay.
A-N-N-I-N-G.
Okay.
And maybe I'm wrong, or maybe he had a drugstore in Banning and then retired to Paso Robles later on. I just don't know.
Yeah, but I'll have to check. He could have been from Banning at the time. Okay.
Yeah, you might check, because Banning is sort of, the eastern side of California and not too far from the lower Colorado River. And I think that he'd spent time on the lower Colorado.
That's right.
Below Lake Mead.
That's right.
And he had a drugstore with a soda fountain. I recall him telling about that. And he invited me to come anytime to his soda fountain at Banning and ask for a sock dollager sundae. He'd give me the biggest ice cream sundae that anyone could ever have. And I'm still drooling with that thought.
Oh.
I never got there. But I would love to go have a sock dollager sundae with Ed Hudson.
Oh, my gosh.
He's a very nice guy, very friendly. He just, I don't know whether avuncular would be the right description, but he was a very nice guy. And he'd also gotten hooked on the Colorado River. And I guess after that trip, he spent a lot more time trying to run boats up the river, as Odie was trying to do.
I'd like to ask you about that. Otis Marston, in 1950, sort of pondered the 1942 river trip. Who amongst those people would actually build a boat, a motorboat, and drive it through Grand Canyon? He thought that Ed Hudson was the last person he would think of who would do that out of that group in 1942. Does that kind of fit your recollections?
Yeah, I think Ed, that first of all, trying to do something like that must have been expensive.
Right.
And you don't think of a guy who owns a small town drugstore as being in a position to spend big sums of money on something like that. On the other hand, Ed obviously loved playing in that river. And, when people really love to do something, they find a way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I'm not terribly surprised that he continued and got deeply involved in trying to come up river and all that sort of thing.
Okay. It was an interesting observation from Odie.
Yeah, yeah. Because he was a small town drugstore owner. He wasn't.
Yeah.
How to describe it. He was just a good, just a nice man, just a great, big, jovial, nice man. But I guess this is what he wanted to do.
Did you learn anything new that you didn't know about Otis Marston on that trip?
Well, I always thought of Otis as being a rather serious guy, but always very, you know, very nice to me. We always got along fine. He was true to form all the way through. He was very intent on whatever he wanted to do. He had a sense of humor, but he was also a serious guy. He had very strong convictions.
How so?
He had strong likes and dislikes. Again, I mean, he and I weren't in a position at my age as a little kid, to be exchanging deep ideas with each other. That's for sure.
Right.
But I stayed in touch with him in the Bohemian Club until it must have been in the 1980s.
Okay.
And he had strong opinions, and I didn't. He had strong opinions about Norm Neville's that I wasn't really all that aware of when we were on the trip.
Right. I don't think he was either.
maybe he was.
In 1942. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, you know, as the years went by, he already felt, I believe, that Norm was too cautious and lined rapids when he could have run them and that sort of thing. But I never really agreed with that because I always felt that Norm's purpose for being on the river wasn't just for recreation, or he was trying to feed his family.
Right.
And he was trying to build a business, and I respected that he wasn't going to be able to do that successfully if he had a bunch of drowned passengers.
Right, so, that's right.
You know, I never really debated that with Cody. Maybe a little bit I debated it with Garth. That last time I saw Garth, I think I told you when somebody else was interviewing both of us. Garth, you know, was talking about the same way his dad would maybe have talked about things like this, and we disagreed.
As normal people can.
Yeah, as normal people can. Nothing, you know. Yeah. We're still good friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what do you remember then about Norm on that river trip?
Well, he was, he was the boss. And he was our leader. He was our cook. Press did some of the cooking, but Norm was essentially the cook. I think in an earlier conversation, I told you how Norm, he loved mashed potatoes. He had to have mashed potatoes every night. And of course, by the end of 3 weeks, the potatoes were growing sprouts. Got a little bit wet. But that was all right. We had mashed potatoes every night, and Norm would do the mashing, and he would put that pot between his knees, or he put it on a rock or something, and he'd start beating with the potato masher, and one leg would start jumping up and down. His knee would be pumping in rhythm with mashing the potatoes, and it was a sight to see. And there'd be sand hitting in them, and pieces of wood chips, everything else. It didn't matter. We had mashed potatoes, and they tasted pretty good. It was great. I'll never forget that. I remember the way he handled those big oars always impressed me. I mean, the guy wasn't a big man, but he He handled those oars, weighed a ton. He just, he could really handle that boat. Quite a guy.
So there was some kind of fooling around on the trip that got filmed between you and Garth. I think Garth is tickling your toe and you're trying to sleep, and then you kind of come up with a start and start chucking rocks at him. Do you remember that? Was that all staged? Was some of this stuff just staged out to show?
I don't believe it was staged. I don't really remember that particular thing.
Okay.
But I don't think it was staged. The only thing I remember vaguely, and it's very vaguely, but I do remember vaguely that we tried to stage something where Garth and I were in the boat, and I don't know, people were hanging on the other side and making sure that we wouldn't go astray or something.
He's rowing and you're sitting behind him, kind of, you know, giving him directions, kind of looking downstream, and the boat's kind of cruising along.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember that.
There's another one where Garth throws a bunch of cans up the beach, and there's a film of him throwing the cans, and then there's a film of you just sitting there, just casually catching these cans, just like, you know, nothing unusual about this here, you know, move along. And it's a great little clip.
I don't remember that.
Okay.
It was a long time ago.
1942.
1942.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So, down.
We had fun. I mean, it was a fun trip. It wasn't something like, an ordeal that we forced ourselves through to go down the Colorado River and run the rapids. It was just a really fun trip.
Yeah, yeah. I think everybody felt that way. There's a couple more things I want to ask you about here as we get kind of close to starting to wrap this up. One is the camp at Bridge Canyon. There was a dam site there. Bureau of Reclamation was doing drilling and looking for a dam site potential there. And
yes.
I think you guys stopped there and got some food. What do you remember about that place?
I remember eating, dining, and they had chairs and you sat down at a table. It might have had a tent. It might have been in a tent.
Uh-huh.
A big tent. I'm not sure about that.
I think that's right.
Really good food. I mean, they had, I guess you don't send people out on that sort of a job without having a cook and somebody getting supplies to feed them.
Right.
And so that was a real meal that we had, and it really tasted good. I think they had cold lemonade. Oh, man, that tasted good.
Huh, okay. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the initiation at Diamond Creek.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember getting whacked pretty good. I think, I think that maybe Press or some of the guys had been a little annoyed by the fact that here was a 13-year-old kid that wasn't really carrying his own weight when it came to lining the boats over the rapids that we did not run. They didn't let me partake in that work because they thought it was too dangerous for me.
And mm-hmm.
I probably wasn't strong enough to be any good anyway. So I would take a nap or something, and everybody else was working their butts off. So there maybe had been a little feeling there that here's a chance to to even that up a little bit. So I got a pretty good whack. But again, it was a fun time, and it was a great experience. And I was a member. member of the Colorado River Rat Society, and I was very proud of that.
Nice.
Still am.
Nice. Very good.
I think Press took a really good whack at Olson, and I don't know any stories or any gossip about that, but maybe there was a little tension between them from time to time.
There was, yeah. Doc talked about that.
Yeah.
And you know, that's. But hey, if you're on your hands and knees with your rear end in the air, and someone else is going to hit your rear end with an oar, they can let you have it if they really want to. And
yeah, I think he gave him a really good crack. I never really felt that I knew Ed Olson all that well. I don't recall spending any time with him at all.
Okay.
On that trip.
All right.
He's probably a really nice guy. Probably a really good guy. But
he was.
I just
was busy filming.
He was busy filming. He was busy filming, and he was in the third boat, and I was in the first boat.
Okay.
And you know.
Yeah.
I was probably just sort of a pain in the butt kid on the trip, you know. But anyway.
So, this is probably a good place to wrap up this part one. Oral history. Before we finish the interview and turn the machine off, I'm wondering if there's anything else about this 1942 Grand Canyon River trip that you would like to mention as well.
Well, I think I would like to mention the trip across Lake Mead.
Yes.
It was an all-night affair. We were towed by Harry Hillison, and I mean that's a big body of water.
Yeah.
And, I remember Norm saying that when Buzz Hallstrom, I think that was his name.
Yes, that's right.
Down by himself, made a single guy's trip down there, and he hadn't made any arrangements to be picked up. And he was out there on Lake Mead trying to get to some civilization. And, you know, if anybody came by in a bigger ship, he'd wave, and they just thought he was waving to them.
That's right.
Pretty stressful.
Yeah. What do you remember about Harry?
Well, I remember Harry had a little mustache, and he had that big powerboat, and he wanted to go upstream, and we watched him bucket up rapids down there at the foot of at the entry to Lake Mead, and he made a run at it, and would get up, the engine would roar, and nothing, he wouldn't make it, but he seemed like a nice guy, so.
And he piloted you guys across the lake there in the dark.
Yeah, it was dark, but he towed the boats and got us over to Las Vegas. So.
Wow.
Or Boulder City, I guess it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then we took an airplane home. That was big stuff. That was the first time I'd ever been in a plane. We flew home.
That would have been a TWA.
I guess so. I don't remember the airline, but it probably was TWA, and it was a surprise to me. I didn't know
that
we were going to do that, so that was a big deal.
Wow, first flight.
Yep, first flight. Yeah. So the whole trip was a great adventure.
Wow, when you went back to school there in the fall of 1942, and somebody said, "What did you do on your summer vacation?" Wow.
I had some stories to tell.
You did.
But, you know, I don't remember talking about it a whole lot. I just,
huh.
I mean, people didn't know about the Colorado River, and it didn't mean anything to any of the people I knew and I went to school with. So, you know, they weren't all that interested.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I have a ton of questions for you for the next interview, which will be part two.
Okay.
It sounds like let's go ahead and we'll wrap this interview up here.
Okay.
This is the end of part one Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Bruce Wilson. My name is Tom Martin, and today is Thursday. It's the 3rd of January, 2019, and that completes part one.